Chapter 25. Napoleon, what's this of Alexander? Weep, did he, like his old namesake, but for meaner cause? Ha, ha. Berthier, word goes, you majesty, that Colonel Toll, one of Field Marshal Price Couch's of staff, in the retreating swirl of overthrow, found Alexander seated on a stone, beneath a leafless roadside apple tree, out here by goading on the Hollich way. His coal-black uniform and snowy plume unmarked, his face disconsolate, his gray eyes mourning in tears the fate of his brave array all flying southward, save the steadfast slain. Napoleon, poor devil. But he'll soon get over it sooner than his employers oversee. Ha! This well make friend Pitt and England writhe, and cloud somewhat their lustrous Trafalgar. An open carriage approaches from the direction of Hollich, accompanied by a small escort of Hungarian guards. Napoleon walks forward to meet it as it draws up, and welcomes the Austrian Emperor, who alights. He is wearing a gray cloak over a white uniform, carries a light walking cane, and is attended by Prince John of Liechtenstein, Schwarzenberg, and others. His fresh-colored face contrasts strangely with the bluish pallor of Napoleon's, but it is now thin and anxious. They formally embrace. Berthier, Prince John, and the rest retire, and the two emperors are left by themselves before the fire. Napoleon, here on the roofless ground, do I receive you my only mansion for these 2 months past? Francis, your tenancy thereof has brought such fame, that it must needs be one which charms you, sire. Napoleon, good. Now this war. It has been forced on me just at a crisis most inopportune, when all my energies and arms were bent on teaching England that her watery walls are no defense against the wrath of France aroused by breach of solemn covenants. Francis, I had no zeal for violating peace till ominous events in Italy revealed the gloomy truth, that France aspires to conquest there, and undo sovereignty. Since when mine eyes have seen no sign outheld to signify a change of purposings. Napoleon, yet there were terms distinctly specified to General Guillet in November past, whereon I'd gladly fling the sword aside. To wit, that hot armigerant jealousy stir us no further on Transalpine rule, I'd take the Isonzo River as our bounds. Francis, roundly, that I see all. And how may stand your views, as to the Russian forces here? Napoleon, you have all to lose by that alliance, sire. Leave Russia. Let the Emperor Alexander make his own terms, whereof the first must be that he retire from Austrian territory. I'll grant an armistice therefore. Anon I'll treat with him to weld a lasting peace, based on some simple undertakings. Chief, that Russian armies keep to the ports of his domain. Meanwhile to you, I'll tender this good word. Keep Austria to herself. To Russia bound, you pay your own costs with your provinces, Alexander's likewise therewithal. Francis, I see as much, and long have seen it, sire, and standing here the vanquished, let me own what happier issues might have left unsaid. Long, long I have lost the wish to bind myself to Russia's purposings and Russia's risks. Little do I count these alliances with powers that have no substance seizable. As they converse they walk away. An Austrian officer, O strangest scene of an eventful life, this junction that I witness here today. An emperor in whose majestic veins Aeneas and the proud Caesarian line claim yet to live, and, though scarce less renowned, the dauntless hawk's hold counts, of gallantry so great in fame 1,000 years ago to bend with deference, and manners mild and talk with this adventuring campaigner, raised but by pikes above the common herd. Another Austrian officer, eh? There be Sachsen swamps and Pratzen heights and royal lines, as here at Austerlitz. The emperors again draw near. Francis, then, to this armistice, which shall be called immediately at all points, I agree, and pledge my word, that my August ally accept it likewise, and withdraw his force by daily measured march to his own realm. Napoleon, for him, I take your word. And pray believe that rank ambitions are your own, not mine, that though I have postured as your enemy, and likewise Alexander's, we are one in interests, have in all things common cause. One country sows these mischiefs Europe through by her insidious chink of luring or false-featured England, who, to aggrandize her name, her influence, and her revenues, schemes to impropriate the whole world's trade, and starves and bleeds the folk of other lands. Her rock-rim situation walls her off like a slim selfish mollusk in its shell from the white views, and fair fraternities which on the mainland we reciprocate, and quits her quest for profit in our woes. Francis, I am not competent, your majesty, to estimate that country's conscience now, nor engage on my allies' behalf, that English ships be shut from Russian trade. But joyful am I that in all things else my promise can be made, and that this day our conference ends in friendship and esteem. Napoleon, I will send Savary at tomorrow's blink, and make all lucid to the Emperor. For us, I wholly can avow as mine the cordial spirit of your majesty.
They retire towards the carriage of Francis. Berthier, Savary, Liechtenstein, and the suite of officers advance from the background, and with mutual gestures of courtesy and amicable leave-takings the two emperors part company.
Chorus of the pities, aerial music, each for himself, his family, his heirs, for the wan weltering nations who concerns, who cares. Chorus of ironic spirits, a pertinent query, in truth. But spoil not the sport by your ruth. Tis enough to make half yonder zodiac laugh, when rulers begin to allude to their lack of ambition, and strong opposition to all but the general good. Spirit of the years, hush levities. Events press. Turn ye westward.
A nebulous curtain draws slowly across.
Scene by Shockerwick House, near Bath,
the interior of the picture gallery. Enter Wiltshire, the owner, and Pitt, who looks emaciated and walks feebly.
Wiltshire, pointing to a portrait, now here you have the lady we discussed. A fine example of his manner, sir. Pitt, it is a fine example, sir, indeed, with that transparency amid the shades, and those thin blue-green-grayish leafages behind the pillar in the background there, which seem the leaves themselves. Ah, this is Quinn.
Moving to another picture.
Wiltshire, yes, Quinn. A man of varied parts, though rough and choleric at times. Yet, at his best, as Falstaff, never matched, they say. But I had not the fate to see him in the flesh. Pitt, Churchill well carves him in his character. His eyes, in gloomy socket taught to roll, proclaim the sullen habit of his soul. In fancied scenes, as in life's real plan, he could not for a moment sink the man. Nature, in spite of all his skill, crept in. Horatio, Dorax, Falstaff style 'twas Quinn. He was at Bath, when Gainsborough settled there in that house in the circus which we know. I like the portrait much. The brilliant eye of Gainsborough lies in this his double sway. Sovereign of landscape he, of portraiture joint monarch with Sir Joshua. That's hark. Is that the patter of horses' hoofs along the road?
Wiltshire, I notice nothing, sir.
Pitt, it is a gallop, growing quite distinct. And can it be a messenger for me?
Wiltshire, I hope no ugly European news to stop the honor of this visit, sir. They listen. The gallop of the horse grows louder, and is checked at the door of the house. There is a hasty knocking, and a courier, splashed with mud from hard riding, is shown into the gallery. He presents a dispatch to Pitt, who sits down and hurriedly opens it.
Pitt, to himself, oh heavy news indeed, disastrous, dire. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.